At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Ah, the dollar, the greenback, the world's reserve currency, stronger now than it's been in 7 years, which might, actually, the way these things go, mean trouble. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's great to have you here on this Monday, everybody. It is the 8th of December today, and we will begin on the foreign exchange markets, the buying and selling of currencies, and what that means in this global economy. Since June, the dollar is up 11% against the euro, 16% against the Japanese yen. Good news for Americans who want to spend their money abroad. Great news for companies overseas who want to sell us their stuff. But on the theory that economic positives only rarely come without at least some downside, there is more to consider here. And not just that it's now harder for American companies to sell their stuff abroad. I'm talking about debt and how a lot of foreign companies are loaded down with it, and that a lot of that debt is priced in dollars, which means it is getting pricier for them by the day, that debt is. Marketplace's Stan Alcorn gets us going.
From Brazil to China, companies are borrowing U.S. dollars, and they're borrowing a lot.
The numbers are largely in the trillions with a T.
Doug Redeker, a visiting fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics, says it really kicked off after the financial crisis, when central banks lowered interest rates and U.S. investors got sick of savings account level returns.
They were effectively incentivized to go seek other places to use your money, and they did.
They lent their money to companies in India, Mexico, South Africa. Those companies get paid locally in rupees, pesos, and rand, but now they were borrowing in dollars. Samir Samana is an international strategist at Wells Fargo. He says the number one reason those companies switched to greenbacks is it made it easier to find lenders.
Number two is it's cheaper.
Since investors understand dollars, they'll lend at a lower interest rate.
And then three is this foreign exchange component.
When the dollar was weak, the money was cheap for those companies. But no longer. Boris Schlossberg is a foreign exchange strategist at BK Asset Management.
The revenue that they're earning in their own currency, which is declining. Whereas debt that they have to pay in the U.S. dollar, which is appreciating. So there's a double whammy.
And it's that double whammy that concerns the Peterson Institute's Doug Redeker.
You've got to assume that if it sucks for one company, then it will suck for more than one company.
And if enough companies are affected, he says it poses a risk for all of us. I'm Stan Alcorn for Marketplace.
There was a mega deal today in the superbugs space. Merck, the pharmaceutical conglomerate, is buying a maker of next-generation antibiotics called Cubist. Price tag is more than $8 billion. For years now, drug companies have been getting out of the antibiotics market. But the deal today is a change, and it is, yes, what you think it's all about, money. Marketplace's Scott Tong reports.
This deal upends conventional thinking about the antibiotics market. Yes, 23,000 Americans die each year from infections resistant to drugs. Yes, overprescribing worsens the problem. But big drug companies have been exiting this space. It's not lucrative, says Michael Kinch. He runs a business innovation center at Washington University in St. Louis.
Why would you work on a drug that costs $20 or $30 per dose when you can work on, for example, a cancer therapeutic, which may be tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars?
The Merck deal may make sense in a climate where big drug companies now focus less on blockbusters and more on targeted drugs. So says Jeff Wager, co-founder and CEO of startup Enbiotics, Inc. And he says if new antibiotics shorten hospital stays, insurance companies will be hot to pay for them.
The benefits of potentially curing someone of an infection sooner and get them out of the hospital that much quicker can result in some pretty dramatic savings to the payers.
There are also federal grants for antibiotic development. Still, Professor Kinch sees a risk here. What if Merck buys Cubist, makes some money, and then guts it?
What we've seen in a lot of past acquisitions where a large company buys a small is that they'll basically get rid of the R&D staff. And that would truly be a loss from the perspective that Cubist has demonstrated its capabilities.
Which would set back research on superbugs. The big question is whether this deal suggests a real business model for antibiotics, with payoffs for society and investors. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Okay, you know how I said there is rarely an unmitigated economic good? You want to know why Wall Street fell today? Just check out those falling oil prices, everybody. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Attorney General Eric Holder released new limits today on the use of racial profiling by federal law enforcement agencies. There are some loopholes, as you know, but the Justice Department is hoping the guidelines will be a model for local police to use as well. Diversity among local police departments has been much talked about since the recent police killings of unarmed black men in Ferguson, Missouri, and in New York City. But as Nova Sappho reports, having a diverse police force won't do it all by itself. You got to figure out how to get that workforce trained. Here's Nova.
When Nelson Lim of the RAND Center on Quality Policing thinks about diversifying police forces, he thinks about the job application process and how difficult that is.
They have to take the test. So then you have to pass the written test, you pass the physical test, then you have to go through a very extensive background check.
These can be daunting challenges for any police applicant, but Lim, who assisted the Los Angeles Police Department in the mid-2000s with its diversification efforts, says there are additional hurdles for minority candidates. Take those written tests, for example.
Because the K-12 education system is not equal across communities, so that their performance in standardized tests, minorities tend to perform lower.
Because of historically troubled relationships between police and minority communities, Lim says it's also harder to recruit from those communities. David Skolansky of Stanford Law School has also studied the issue, and he says lack of diversity has meant a lack of new ideas inside police institutions.
Police departments used to be monolithic, culturally homogeneous, highly insular places.
The good news is, despite the obstacles, many police departments, especially in major cities, are more diverse now than they were 50 years ago. But the bad news is that hasn't automatically led to better relationships with communities.
There certainly are lots of examples of departments with heavy minority presences that have had difficulty getting along with minority communities throughout the country.
In Los Angeles, the police chief during the diversification push was William Bratton. He's credited with turning around the LAPD's tense relationship with minority communities. He did it not just by hiring more minority officers, but also through institutional changes, reconfiguring units, formally tracking racial profiling, and extensive community outreach. Now, Bratton is in charge of the New York Police Department, and he told CBS's Face the Nation over the weekend that he's trying to do the same thing again.
A lot of this is informed by my experience during 2002 to 2009 in Los Angeles. LA is a city you want to look to in terms of how all of this can eventually turn out.
This is Bratton's second stint leading the New York Police Department, and one of his next steps is to retrain the city's entire 20,000-member patrol force. Officials say they'll focus on changing how officers talk and listen to residents and teach them to use less force whenever possible. In New York, I'm Nova Sappho for Marketplace.
All right, here's a thought. Starbucks, not as a coffee company, but as a leader in the use of cutting-edge technology. You laugh, sure, but tell me you haven't seen people in front of you in line, or yes, maybe you yourself, using the Starbucks app for mobile payment, a notoriously tough niche to crack. Now the company is rolling out a program to bring wireless cell phone chargers into its stores. Queenie Kim explains what technology has to do with selling coffee.
Hey, can I get a drip coffee? When I got to Starbucks, my phone was running out of juice. Luckily, the Starbucks in my city has wireless charging. Can I get one of those charging things? But to charge my phone, I need an adapter, which Starbucks loans out for free.
Oh, it's on the table.
On the tables, there were small displays with adapters hanging on it.
See that black thing over there? It's hanging.
Once you plug the adapter into your phone, you put it on top of one of the wireless power mats embedded into the table. The mats are about the size of a coaster and have a slick black surface. 25-year-old Baruch Tamru was charging his phone on one.
I've had this on for 30 minutes, and it charged about like 30%, so it's not bad.
That sounded sort of slow to me, which has been one of the complaints about wireless charging, but Tamru says it's better than nothing.
Not a lot of places have outlets.
In fact, all the tables at this Starbucks in Berkeley were full of people staring at their laptops. There wasn't a free outlet in the house. Plus, Tamru says, it's also sort of fun charging your phone wirelessly.
The novelty of the technology is actually cool, you know? Like, why plug it into the wall like people have been doing for decades?
Starbucks is an older brand, you know? It's not the new kid on the block.
Jonah Berger is the author of Contagious, Why Things Catch On, and a professor at Wharton.
So seeming like they're technology forward, like they know what's going on, you know, that will help move from sort of a fuddy-duddy coffee company to somebody that's on the cutting edge.
Berger says there can be risks to this strategy. If customers are disappointed by the technology, it could come off as gimmicky. Betsy Sigmund is a professor at Georgetown's Business School, and she says increasingly all sorts of restaurants are looking to technology to appeal to younger customers.
McDonald's, the Coffee Bean, Madison Square Garden also use the Power Mat. Starbucks is not the only one out there.
Fast food joints like Taco Bell have introduced apps that let you order food. Sigmund says when done right, the technology gives customers another reason to go to the restaurant to buy more stuff. But Berger, the Wharton professor, thinks Starbucks wants to do more than sell more coffee to young people. It wants to have influence in the way technology is adopted. Right now, there are two competing wireless charging technologies. One's called Qi and another called PowerMat. Starbucks is betting on the latter.
It's definitely the case that if Starbucks can become the market maker for this technology, you know, people are deciding, I'm going to get whatever phone or I'm going to get whatever attachment allows me to charge on this.
If Starbucks can do this, and Berger says it's still a big if, Starbucks could become a powerful player in the tech industry. In San Francisco, I'm Queenie Kim for Marketplace.
The fashion and style magazine Cosmopolitan has teamed up with one of its biggest advertisers, CoverGirl, to buy New Year's Eve, or at least the most famous celebration of it. The pair has agreed to a joint sponsorship of the New Year's Eve festivities in Times Square. Marketplace's Adam Allington reports advertisers are increasingly leaning on live events to promote their products. And oh, by the way, all the better if the event comes with an experiential angle and its own hashtag, too.
The Times Square New Year's Eve ball has a lot going for it in terms of marketing potential. It's an established thing, it's televised around the world, and it's just one of the biggest parties around. Jessica L'Esperance is a vice president of user experience at Huge Incorporated, a digital brand and marketing agency based in New York. She says more and more would-be customers need to see, touch, taste, or smell products before deciding to buy.
Traditional advertising has become a bit stagnant in the face of so much experiential and so much digital marketing and opportunities for conversation.
L'Esperance says flooding a place like Times Square with CoverGirl product allows people to associate with ideas like New York City, reinvention, and fun.
There's no print ad or TV commercial that's really going to, you know, help you see it on your own face. So I think that's actually really brilliant to inundate the area with a little bit of glam.
From Cosmo's perspective, getting one of your advertisers to help foot your marketing bill is a pretty savvy strategy, too. So says Kathy McPhillips of the Content Marketing Institute.
They have the exact same audience. I mean, not the exact same, but give or take. And they're not competitors.
Still, says McPhillips, getting into bed with just one advertiser could backfire for Cosmo.
They run the risk of, will they lose some advertising dollars from some of their other clients because of this partnership?
CoverGirl launches its new Colorlicious line of lipstick this month. Anyone smooching in the new year can tweet the experience under the hashtag Colorful Countdown. I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Most people will say in a panic, I have to spend this money in 2 weeks. Help me.
Okay, we will. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials gave back 106 points to start the week, almost 0.6%, closed at 17,852. The NASDAQ dropped 40 points, more than 0.8%, 4740 there. The S&P 500 off 15 points, 0.7%, ended things at 2060. Falling oil prices continue to fall. Light crude down more than 4% today, $63 a barrel, and thus energy stocks took it on the chin. ExxonMobil off 2.25%, Chevron down 3.6%. After that Merck Cubist deal we told you about, shares in Cubist Pharmaceuticals soared 35%. Merck and Company up 0.6%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note down to 2.26%. You're listening to Marketplace. Marketplace has been on the air for 25 years, and believe me when I tell you that could not have happened without support from listeners like you. So please, make a tax-deductible gift to Marketplace today and help us keep our coverage relevant and compelling. And you should know that your gift in any amount counts twice. That's thanks to a dollar-for-dollar match from the Candida Fund. Donate at marketplace.org by December 31st and help us reach our goal of at least 2,500 donors. And thank you so much for your support. Also, this is Kai Rizdal, in case you didn't know who this was.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, a Senate Judiciary Subcommittee holds a hearing on the state of civil and human rights in the United States. The Labor Department issues its job openings and labor turnover survey for October. And December 9th is Christmas card day. Yeah, I'm behind too. I'm Michelle Filippi.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. It's tough to find a whole lot of good news out there about the Democratic Republic of Congo. The through line is that it's a place rich in resources but plagued by corruption and violence, especially since the Congolese civil wars that started back in 1996. Marketplace's Sabri Benishour is just back from 2 weeks in eastern Congo reporting stories of economic rebuilding there. Hey, Sabri.
Hey, Kai.
Tell me why you were there, first of all.
You know, the Congo is an extraordinary and tragic place. It is a place that is sitting on $24 trillion worth of mineral wealth, and yet it ranks next to last on the planet in terms of human development. And a lot of attention was paid to this place two decades ago, when it was being ripped apart in one of the bloodiest conflicts since World War II. That was when Rwanda's genocide just spilled over into eastern Congo. You know, we heard about mass rapes. We heard about conflict minerals. We heard about armed rebels marauding through the jungle. Well, why not take a look now when things are somewhat stabilizing and see how people are putting themselves back together?
Give me this sneak peek then. Give me a little preview of what you saw.
You know, we talked to some folks who were caught up in armed conflict as children. They, you know, wandered the forest as kids with rebel groups. We're hearing how they're putting their lives back together or not. We're looking at businesses trying to grow. You know, an economy is like a mirror. It's really easy to smash it. It's hard to put it back together. So, you know, if you're trying to rebuild a coffee industry, you need all kinds of financing incentives and loans and people trusting one another to pass their goods on. And it's a very complex sort of thing that you can't just wave a magic wand and make happen again. So the process of reconstructing an economy is an interesting one that we took a look at.
We should probably say that you have been to Congo before 2008, right?
Yes.
Okay, so do the compare and contrast for me. I mean, here we are 6 years later. What has changed, if anything?
Well, when I was there, it was in the middle of what everyone thought was going to be a successful rebel invasion of the capital city there. And it was an utter ghost town. They were people either fleeing for their lives through town, or they were people, you know, burning tires in protest.
Yeah. And this is Goma, right? The capital city.
This is Goma, yeah. You know, a lot of fields were bare. But the Goma I saw this time around, and the fields around it, the areas around it, they were bustling. They were full of life. The streets are full of motorcycle taxis. There's some impressive new construction. But I will say, that said, it still bears a lot of scars.
Not to make it all about us, Sabri, but Congo is far, far away from this country. Make some connections for me, would you?
We are more closely linked than you would think. They use American dollars there. Our monetary policy affects them, for starters. Our laws affect them. When we tried to eradicate conflict minerals, we had a huge impact on their industry. And I don't think we knew that was going to happen at the time. The U.S. as a consumer also is one of the potential drivers for recovery of this area. I mean, to the extent that we buy cocoa or whatever other products from this area, we have a power to this place that we don't maybe recognize. And lastly, I mean, all of our cell phones have minerals that could well have come from this part of the world.
Marketplace's Sabri Benishour from our New York Bureau. His stories from the Congo start tomorrow. Sabri, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Guy.
This time of year typically means plenty of deadlines, financial deadlines in particular, tax deductions to arrange, rebalancings of portfolios, and spending down all the tax-free money you've got left in a healthcare flexible spending account, or FSA. But sometimes, you know, deadlines aren't really deadlines at all. Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein reports now from the Health Desk at WHYY.
What do you do when you've got FSA money burning a hole in your pocket?
You're going to have some thickness, but plus because this is clear in the back, if you polish it, you won't notice it as much.
Turns out, a lot of us go shopping for glasses in places a lot like this one, Modern Eye in West Philadelphia.
Our buzz months are usually in June and December.
Manager Kate Goffrey says she can bank on June when a lot of fiscal years end, and December getting hectic with loads of harried customers.
Most people will say in a panic, I have to spend this money in 2 weeks, help me. And I always just say, don't panic, we're here to help, and I have something in the store for every budget and every face, so let's calm down and have some fun.
People get so worked up because, historically, flexible spending accounts have been use it or lose it. That changed last fall, and now you can set aside up to $2,550 and roll over as much as $500 for the next year.
So there won't be as much of a rush, I think, at the end of the year for employees to spend money on things that they don't really need.
Bruce Elliott with the Society for Human Resource Management says the new rule came out so late in 2013, most employers didn't shift their policies. He expects that to change for 2015. But figuring your annual healthcare budget will still be more art than science. Lucky for us, Elliott says, there's lots of ways to spend down our accounts.
You can use it for just about any medical, dental, or vision expense as long as it's not cosmetic and as long as it's therapeutic.
So you can end up with a wall of contact lens wash or something a little more daring, like these sweet wood glasses I've just found at Modern Eye.
And they come in all these colors. Are you for real?
They're made from some crazy 48,000-year-old New Zealand tree found under volcanic ash.
You can do whatever you want. So.
Oh, wait, look at this green.
So see how this works?
Maybe with some new glasses soon? I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
This is, as we've touched on a couple of times this year, I think, our 25th anniversary on the air. So we've been going through the archives, looking for some of the stories that stuck with us. And one of them was a series called Best Gift Ever. Here is the very first one. It's from December 2004.
My name is Jeff Bezos, and I'm the founder and CEO of Amazon.com. The best gift I ever received was all the construction toys that my grandfather gave me over the years when I was a little kid. You know, Lincoln Logs, Erector Sets, Legos. Every year I'd get a new construction toy of some kind. And then what really turned into the best gift was that I then got to spend all of my summers working with him on his ranch. Ranchers build everything, so I got to do the construction toys for real. We would arc weld gates and build fences and lay pipelines. Building things is something that has served me well all throughout the years. And in fact, I love construction toys to this day, and I love them so much that for my 5th wedding anniversary, my wife gave me a huge 5-foot-tall tool chest filled to the brim with Legos.
That was Jeff Bezos, the CEO of Amazon back then. He is, of course, still the CEO of Amazon. We want to hear the story of your best gift ever. Hit us up at marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out today, a nod to the Yuletide labor market, I guess you could say. The insurance website Insure.com used Labor Department wage and hour data to come up with a suggested salary for Santa Claus. $139,924 this year. It's a bump of about 1.5% over 2013. They also commissioned a survey to see how much people think Santa Claus should get paid. 29% of people, and I don't understand this at all, said not a dime. 29% said $1.8 billion, which works out to about a buck for each child on the planet under the age of 15. A note here on methodology. The survey, it was an online self-selecting survey, polled 895 adults who said Santa Claus does, in fact, visit their homes. Also, just because we have a little extra time, remember a couple of weeks ago I told you about that new Discovery Channel show called Eaten Alive, where the guy was going to get eaten alive by a giant anaconda wearing a special suit and everything? Well, it turns out, shocker, he wasn't, in fact, eaten alive. And special bonus shocker, when people who tuned into the premiere last night found out he wasn't eaten alive by a giant anaconda, they were upset about it. I don't know what to say. I honestly don't. Except this, we gotta go. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Tommy Andres, Daisy Palacios, and Gina Delvac. I am Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. Seriously, a giant anaconda, come on.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.